This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Two quotations. This will be the section on sodomy laws and on liberty. And so the first quote is from Justice Stevens's dissenting opinion in Bowers versus Hardwick. Although the meaning of the principle that all men are created equal is not always clear, it surely must mean that every free citizen has the same interest in liberty that the members of the majority share. From the standpoint of the individual, the homosexual and the heterosexual have the same interest in deciding how he will live his own life, and more narrowly, how he will conduct himself in his personal and voluntary associations with his companions. State intrusion into the private conduct of either is equally burdensome. Then the second quote is from Michael Hardwick himself, describing his arrest in his own bedroom. I asked Officer Torek if he would leave the room so we could get dressed, and he said, "There's no reason for that, because I have already seen you in your most intimate aspect." Sodomy laws are intrusive. Under the laws that used to exist in all states, what people did in seclusion, without any effect on others, without even the knowledge of outsiders, could become the basis for criminal prosecution and often for severe criminal punishment. Today, I think to most Americans, it seems outrageous that the police would have the right to enter someone's bedroom and try to find out what sexual acts are being performed there. Officer Torek's response to Hardwick's polite request conjures up for most people the image of a police state, and it looks like people don't want to go there. But despite the fact that there has been this shift in people's perceptions, the road to a decisive rejection of that kind of governmental scrutiny and control of consensual intimate conduct was long and difficult. Hardwick died in 1991 before he could see the vindication of his own right to intimate association. Legal regulation of sexual conduct raises deep questions about the kind of society that we want to live in. Lord Devlin, who was the most famous defender of sodomy laws and who engaged over the years in lots of debates on this, preferred a picture of society in which the key value is solidarity. Personal liberty, he conceded, counts for something, but it can always be trumped by sufficiently strong feelings of disgust and abhorrence on the part of the majority. So that's the basic idea that throughout the book I'm tracking. It's what I call the politics of disgust. Devlin was aiming his arguments, above all, against the very different conception of society favored by British 19th century philosopher John Stuart Mill. And in fact, he once part of his work was presented here at the University of Chicago Law School, and his most explicit attack on Mill was presented here under the title of the Ernst Freund Lecture, which I, you know, now that I held the Ernst Freund chair, I view as a profound insult to Freund and all that he stood for. Well, I mean, Freund was a civil libertarian. So anyway, Mill lived in an England which was even more intrusive and puritanical than yesterday's America. As a young man, Mill went to jail for distributing contraceptive information among the poor in London. As an adult, for long stretches of his life, he was treated as a social pariah because of his close personal friendship with Harriet Taylor, a married woman, even though the two almost certainly didn't even sleep together until after her husband died, and her husband never objected to the association. So nonetheless, the people treated him as a pariah. So on the basis of this and other experiences, Mill, who insisted on being buried in France and not in England because he abhorred England by this time, he came to abhor the tyranny of the majority and of public opinion over personal choice. In his famous work on liberty, he argues that conduct that involves only the interests of those who participate in it, which he calls self-regarding conduct, was never a proper object of legal regulation. Gambling, drinking alcohol, unusual sexual behavior, all these might be very morally objectionable to most people, but they can't be legally regulated as long as they involve only those who choose to perform them. Conduct becomes an object of legal regulation, he says, only when it becomes other regarding, that is, impacting directly the interests of others. Now, behind Mill's distinction, I think, is a deep idea about people that has gradually been recognized in our constitutional tradition, namely that people need zones of freedom around them in order to work out their own course in life, and that these zones of freedom ought to protect, above all, certain rights of intimate personal decision and association. A society that protects these zones of liberty, Mill believed, will be both more fair to individuals and stronger as a society than a society that allows conventional norms to tyrannize over individual liberty. Now, to see what's at issue between Devlin and Mill, I think we need to distinguish three different ways in which sexual conduct might potentially affect the interests of others. First, it might involve some kind of violence or coercion. Both Devlin and Mill agree that that sort of conduct, for example, rape or child abuse, is properly regulated by law. Second, it might involve the infliction of a direct offense that's comparable to a harm or a rights violation. And we can understand this category most easily by thinking of the legal category of nuisance, disgusting smells or sounds on my neighbor's property, spoil my enjoyment of my own property, thus giving me a cause of legal action. Here we can see that rights are being directly violated by the nuisance in a way that looks very much like a harm. Okay, now how to apply this to sexual conduct is a very long matter, and I'm not going to be able to go into that here, but I think we could at least argue that public masturbation and some kinds of public sexual conduct might fall under that rubric, because the person is present at the act and it inflicts directly a kind of offense that's harm-like. I'm very unsure about this, really, but at least we could make that concession to the opposition. But finally, there are cases where the conduct itself is consensual and it takes place in seclusion, not impinging directly on any third party, but other people are upset when they simply think about it happening. That's what Mill calls a merely constructive injury. That is, people imagine what's happening next door, and then they feel offended at the very thought that that's happening. They get all worked up. And of course, many types of consensual sexual conduct that take place in seclusion arouse that type of offense. And there were laws against all of them at one time. Fornication, masturbation, whole category of offenses. You could also mention things that are not directly sexual acts, nude dancing in private clubs, nudity on public beaches, and so on. And to move away from the sexual for a minute, there used to be lots of laws against the private possession and consumption of alcohol. Now, many laws regulating self-regarding conduct remain on the books, and in fact, as recently as 1991, the Supreme Court upheld an Indiana law forbidding nude dancing in private clubs, a law that had been declared unconstitutional by the Seventh Circuit in a very eloquent opinion by Judge Posner. And they said that, contrary to what Posner had written, considerations of public morality made such laws constitutionally acceptable. And in fact, Scalia went to such great length to say that we've never accepted Mill's principle. The debate between Devlin and Mill is about this last group of cases, the merely constructive injury. For Devlin, the imaginary disgust, the disgust as a result of imagining of the average member of society, is sufficient reason to regulate self-regarding conduct, even though the actions in question take place in seclusion. For Mill, protecting those zones of seclusion and liberty is one of the hallmarks of a decent society. What's involved I think, as we shift in America from the Devlin sort of politics to a politics of individual liberty, is this more general question about what sort of society we want to have. And I think, in essence, it's the debate between proponents of collectivism and proponents of important spheres of individual liberty. And this is not a left-right issue, and I think this is very important to see that. Many Marxist movements have been just as intrusive in sexual matters as the most vehement religious conservatives. In the 1970s, when I was in graduate school, leftist movements on campuses prescribed what correct sexual behavior was for men and women, what clothes good men and women could wear, when one could get married and when one could not, and so on. And they were disagreeing with conservatives not about the propriety of regulation and intrusion, but only about the content of what could get regulated. In the middle, but it wasn't really a middle at all, sat the uncomfortable million, dismayed by the rather cavalier way in which both sides treated individual liberty. All right, so the question, I think, then, is not really whether we should like the left better than the right. The question, instead, is whether at the deepest level of our political organization, we think that the fundamental political unit, the primary bearer of entitlements, is the person or the group. Does the individual have certain zones of freedom, certain rights that can't be taken away by the judgments of a majority, or does the collective interest always, as Devlin thinks, trump individual entitlement? In the area of religion, interestingly, America has been much more individualistic than Europe. I mean, so Europe, you see now all these laws regulating what articles of religious dress can and can't be worn, laws that would certainly be unconstitutional here. In the area of sex, by contrast, America has been more collectivistic, more willing to allow majorities to dictate what individuals do, and continental Europe has been more protective of the individual. All laws against consensual adult sexual activity were abolished in France, for example, early in the 20th century, at a time when anal intercourse, whether heterosexual or homosexual, was still a capital offense in Britain. So, I mean, Britain and the U.S. are closely allied. Now, in the chapter, I go into a lot of history about the sodomy laws. I won't have time to do that here, but I hope if you have questions about that, you'll raise them. But now on to constitutional law. Now, in the next section, I look at the whole history of recognizing unenumerated rights under the 14th Amendment. I think there's a confusion in the public mind, and it is that somehow these left-wing justices recognized a right to privacy, and that in doing that, they did something fundamentally new that has no constitutional backing and no justification. So what I try to point out is that really, for a very long time, there had been a long and deep tradition of recognizing unenumerated rights, first of all, under the Equal Protection Clause. The right to vote is an unenumerated right, and that is recognized as implicit in the Equal Protection Clause, so too the right to travel. But there's an equally long and deep tradition of recognizing unenumerated rights under the Due Process Clause. And these are rights typically of intimate association. Although in Griswold the focus was indeed on the married couple, that was quickly extended to the unmarried in Eisenstadt versus Baird, the case concerning the distribution of contraceptives by an activist at a public rally. And that case makes it clear that the right to privacy is not the right of a couple, it's the right of an individual. And so the argument is that it belongs to the unmarried as much as to the married. Now, so I think there should be no doubt that there are rights of intimate association that have been recognized, firmly ensconced in the tradition under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. But that's not to say that it was that the way that Justice Douglas did it in Griswold, recognized invoking the notion of privacy, was the right way to do it. So now I want to look at the notion of privacy. Privacy, I think, is one of the most vague and confusing concepts in the law. It includes ideas of informational secrecy, modesty, seclusion, and decisional autonomy in a way that's potentially quite confusing. In the area of sexual liberty, the idea of privacy suggests, first of all, and I think centrally, an idea of decisional freedom, the idea that certain choices, who to have sex with, who to have a child with, whether to use contraception or not, are for the person to make on his or her own with no supervision from the state. But second, it also suggests an idea of seclusion, which has some relevance to the idea of protecting others from offense, but it's not always made clear how they see that relevance. And then finally, and this is where the confusion really kicks in, it suggests an idea that Justice Douglas made central in Griswold, namely the idea of the home as a privileged space. Often, it's suggested that the home is the place where government has no business. So in Griswold, for example, Justice Douglas asks rhetorically, would we allow the police to search the sacred precincts of marital bedrooms for telltale signs of the use of contraceptives? Now, the decisional component of privacy and the idea of the home as a protected space are not unrelated. They're connected through the idea of seclusion. If we go back to our three categories of sexual behavior, we can see that it's plausible to believe that the decisions that are a person's own to make, decisions that should not be controlled by the state, are only those that do not directly impact the interests of other people. So the ones in that third category I mentioned. Acts that take place in seclusion, if they're fully consensual, are almost always free from harm or even direct offense to non-consenting parties. So the home is one example of a place of seclusion, although, and this is the problem, it's far from the only example. So if acts are performed in the home and they're fully consensual, then they probably are going to be self-regarding in Mill's sense, and therefore not fit objects of legal regulation. The minute an act gets outside the home, it's in a public place, well, then the likelihood that the interests of non-consenting parties will be involved becomes much higher, but the Millian idea of self-regarding conduct is really not the same idea as the idea of the home as a privileged space. First of all, many actions in the home are not fully consensual, and they do impact adversely the interests of non-consenting parties. And that's something that feminists have long pointed out, attacking the use of the notion of privacy. The appeal to the so-called privacy of the home has been used, unfortunately, in the law, not only in the U.S., but in other countries as well, to protect child abuse, domestic violence, marital rape from the scrutiny of the law. On the other side, and it's really this other side that I'm more interested in here, conduct can be self-regarding in Mill's sense while occurring outside the home, because it might take place in a hotel room or a sex club for members only or some other utterly secluded place. What's unfortunate about Griswold, and we'll see it goes straight through to Lawrence, is not then that it recognizes substantive liberty rights as implicit in the Due Process Clause. What's unfortunate is the way in which Griswold and the subsequent cases do it. Instead of defining clearly the area of decisional liberty to be protected, they chose instead to kind of mix up the decisional aspect with the spatial aspect, suggesting that maybe these decisions are protected only if they take place in a certain place. Well, now let's look at Bowers and see what happened there. And since I think most of you know the story of Hardwick and in its general outlines, but I think it's useful to know it in somewhat more detail. So let me now just tell you what happened. So Michael Hardwick, a gay man, was drinking a beer after work in a gay bar where he had been helping friends with some putting in some insulation. As he prepared to leave the bar, went out the back door, he tossed the beer bottle into the trash can by the door of the bar. At this very moment, a police car happened to drive by. Seeing Hardwick, and of course they knew it was a gay bar, and so they were looking hard, the officer drove back and asked Hardwick where the beer was. Hardwick said he'd thrown the bottle into the trash. The officer made Hardwick get into the police car. And while he was sitting in the police car, right, he asked him what he had been doing in that bar. Hardwick said he worked there, and so immediately he was identified as gay. The policeman then asked Hardwick, show him the bottle that you say you've thrown into the trash. But, well, he couldn't really show him since he was sitting in the police car and he hadn't been given permission to get out of the police car. Couldn't see the bottle in the trash can from the car. He couldn't really do that. So finally, the policeman gave Hardwick a ticket for drinking in public. I mean, that was what this was all about. But the ticket had been filled out wrong. He put two different dates on two different parts of the ticket. So Hardwick, looking at one part of the ticket, didn't show up for the earlier of the two dates. So when he didn't show up for his court date, a warrant was issued for his arrest. 2 hours later, Officer Torek arrived at Hardwick's house. Now, usually it takes 48 hours to process a warrant, but Torek had processed it personally. And the people at the courthouse said, this is very unusual. It's very strange for a policeman to take such a zealous interest in such a case. So when Torek arrived with this warrant, Hardwick was not at home. And a roommate was there, so when Hardwick heard from a roommate that an officer had been there with a warrant, he went downtown and he showed the clerk this ticket with the two dates and he paid his $50 fine. The clerk gave him a receipt, proof that he paid the fine, and he was quite, the clerk expressed surprise that Torek had personally processed the warrant. 3 weeks later, Hardwick was beaten up by a whole bunch of young thugs in front of his own house. So the word that this was a gay man had spread. Several days after that, Officer Torek arrived at Hardwick's house. A visiting friend of Hardwick's, sleeping on the couch, answered the door. Now, you've got the same warrant, right? This is 3 weeks later, and the warrant had been invalid because he paid the fine, invalid for more than 3 weeks. Torek came to the bedroom, opened the door. Hardwick remembers hearing a noise, but then he said he thought it was just the wind. He went back to doing what he was doing, which was mutual oral sex with his partner. Almost a minute went by before Officer Torek made his presence known and announced that Hardwick was under arrest. I said, "For what? What are you doing in my bedroom?" Torek said he had a warrant. Hardwick pointed out that the warrant was no longer valid because he paid the fine. Torek said it didn't matter because he had been acting in good faith. After 3 weeks later, right? After refusing to leave while Hardwick and the friend got dressed, that's the part I read before, he took them to the station house. He announced to all the personnel in the station house that they were gay. Actually, what he said was he told guards and other prison officials that Hardwick was there for cocksucking, and that he should be able to get plenty of that in prison. And Hardwick was booked for sodomy. The Georgia law, which was enacted in 1816, said, quote, "A person commits the offense of sodomy when he performs or submits to any sexual act involving the sex organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another." At this point, the ACLU took an interest in Hardwick's case and decided it was a good basis for a challenge to the sodomy law, since the sex was between consenting adults and it took place in a secluded spot. For a time, a heterosexual couple, known only as the Does in the case, joined the suit because you see that this law was orientation neutral. About half the sodomy laws at this time were orientation neutral. The other half singled out homosexual conduct. But they were denied standing by the district court on the grounds that they were in no danger from the enforcement of the law. So they're conceding that this was really not so neutral. The state strategy when the case went to trial was to focus relentlessly on homosexual conduct. And again, this is part of what I mean by the politics of disgust in the book, and keep putting in people's face something that they think will evoke an adverse reaction, rather than on the broader notion of sexual choice and forbidden sexual acts. When the case was argued before the Supreme Court, Georgia Attorney General Bowers kept referring to homosexuality throughout the argument, and he claimed in his brief, quote, "Homosexuality sexual sodomy leads to other deviant practices such as sadomasochism, group orgies, or transvestism, to name only a few." Hardwick, of course, had never been associated even remotely with any of these practices. Bowers repeatedly also alluded to gay baths and suggested a link between the sodomy law and the state's interest in public health. And there's a lot of Christian right-wing pamphlet stuff that I talk about earlier in the book, which tries to use that kind of scare tactic. There are germs out there that are going to spread through our community. So the tribe, by contrast, who was arguing the case for Hardwick, tried to get the court to focus on the general issue of protected sexual choice and intrusiveness and the limits of government power, emphasizing the secluded and intimate nature of Hardwick's activity in a way that argued for a more general human interest in non-interference. Well, on June 30th, 1986, the court upheld the sodomy law by a 5-4 vote. The result later, as you probably know, became very controversial when it was divulged that Justice Powell had changed his vote to the majority at the last minute, and then later announced that he had regretted his position and decided that he was probably wrong. So the flip-flop of Justice Powell made the majority very insecure. The crucial defect of the majority opinion by Justice White and the even harsher concurrence by Justice Berger is, I would say, a deficiency of ordinary human imagination, of humanity in the sense that I give it throughout the book. That is, a politics that tries to think of people as human and think what are their human purposes. Why, one might ask, would a judge in a constitutional case need to use imagination? Surely their job is to interpret the Constitution faithfully. Yes, certainly, but this case, like many hard cases that reach the Supreme Court, can't be resolved by any kind of handy technical argument. Instead, judges have to consider relevant similarities and differences, and this means they have to try to understand human aims and interests. In order to determine whether the rights curtailed by the Georgia sodomy law are protected by the Due Process Clause, a judge, first of all, has to figure out what the relevant specification of those rights is. Shall we think of the law as threatening a right of all persons to consensual intimate association? So described, the right looks like one that is protected under the 14th Amendment, and that, of course, was the way the Georgia law was written, so that naturally suggested that general specification. But on the other hand, Justice White followed the path mapped out by Bowers in oral argument, construing the issue narrowly as, quote, whether the federal constitution confers a fundamental right upon homosexuals to engage in sodomy. He then says he finds it, quote, evident that none of the rights announced in those earlier privacy cases bears any resemblance to the claimed constitutional right of homosexuals to engage in acts of sodomy. To claim due process clause protection for such a right is, he said, quote, at best facetious. Similarly, Berger, in a very harsh concurring opinion, opines, quote, the prescriptions against sodomy have very ancient roots, and he concludes, to hold that the act of homosexual sodomy is somehow protected as a fundamental right would be to cast aside millennia of moral teaching, end quote. Now, these judgments get some bad things badly wrong on the facts. I mean, the history that they use is very faulty, but I won't have time to go into that. But history is not the primary problem. They're morally obtuse in a way that's really quite shocking. Even at the time when widespread animus and prejudice against homosexuals existed in the U.S., it should have been easy to see that what they were asking to be able to do legally bore not no resemblance, but actually a very close resemblance to what heterosexuals seek to do and were not impeded by the sodomy laws could do legally. And of course, the fact that the law was orientation neutral made the resemblance all the more obvious. It had already been established by Eisenstadt, if it wasn't clear already, that the rights associated with sexual intimacy are individual rights, and rights of the unmarried person as well as the married person. Well, then it doesn't take a very great leap of creativity, but only a rather ordinary sort of imagination, to see that this was the sort of thing that Michael Hardwick was asking to have vindicated. So how could someone in good faith conclude that there was no resemblance between the rights invoked in his case and those recognized in others? Now here, I think, again, we need to think about the way disgust operates in politics, the way in which homosexuals were standardly portrayed as some sort of something slimy, something not quite fully human, something like the cockroach that crawls under your kitchen floor, so you sort of know it's there, but you don't really want to look at it. And I think that's, you know, that was very deep in American society at that time. Years of that kind of stigmatization of gays and lesbians and their sexual acts made it all too easy for judges, who, of course, were unaware, as Powell later admitted, that some of their friends and associates were gay or lesbian, to talk about them as a class of moral pariahs who were not really like other humans. So this is in Devlin, too, you see this. He compares homosexuals to drug addicts. He says they're so sunk in debauchery that they wouldn't be able to answer their country's call to duty. And you know, so he goes on in that way. And, of course, doesn't ask whether there's any reason to think they're more addicted to sex than heterosexuals. So So this idea that there's a weird category of people who do unspeakable things was, and I think still is, very, very prominent. If you look even at very good-hearted conservative works, you still see it around the edges. Charles Fried's excellent book, Modern Liberty, which does roundly castigate the court for Bowers and says that it's inhumane, and he says some very nice things. At the same time, he says, to think this way, we can't think about the sex acts that homosexuals perform. We have to instead call our mind away from that and think of a more abstract notion of sex. So this disgust was very much in the picture. Now, then, even further reinforcing the harshness of these opinions is their Devlin-esque character. They allude to longstanding traditions as if by themselves these traditions settle the matter of what rights individuals have under the Constitution. So, in effect, the two sides in Bowers replay the Devlin-Mill debate, the fact that shows us clearly what's really at stake in the choice of these two models of society. Now, Bowers was a low point in recent Supreme Court jurisprudence. Its result and the harshness of the majority and concurring opinions not only left vital liberty interests unaddressed, but also gave comfort to the idea that gays were outlaws, stigmatizing them. I mean, it had broad, sweeping impact on whether, for example, a gay or lesbian person could be nominated to be a judge and so on. So they were outlaws. So anti-gay violence also was very much fueled by this. In its restricting of the individual's vital interest in the name of majority prejudice, the case resembles ugly cases from the past like Plessy versus Ferguson, which upheld the constitutionality of racial segregation, and Bradwell versus Illinois, which upheld the Illinois law forbidding women to practice law in the state, citing majority views of what women could or couldn't do. Perhaps even more uncannily similar, I think, is Minersville versus Gobitis, the case in which the court upheld a compulsory flag salute law against a challenge from Jehovah's Witnesses, who refused the salute on grounds of idolatry. The suggestion that witnesses were outlaws and subversives, if they obeyed their conscience, let loose an ugly torrent of violence against them all across the U.S. So those cases are really the ones with which we should classify Bowers. So now let's just turn to Lawrence versus Texas and the overruling and see how that happened. Now, in the middle, as most of you know, came Romer versus Evans, a case that did not involve the Due Process Clause. It was a non-discrimination case and argued entirely under the Equal Protection Clause. But in 1996, that was decided, and they sidestepped Bowers versus Hardwick, not saying whether it was rightly decided or not, but letting it stand and just simply overruled the referendum in Colorado that had restricted the opportunities of gays and lesbians to pass non-discrimination laws protecting themselves. Meanwhile, the political struggle about sodomy laws had moved to the states, and many of the states that had sodomy laws at the time of Bowers got rid of them. From 50 in 1961, the number dropped to 24 by the time of Bowers in 1986, and it had gone down to 16 by the time they were invalidated in 2003. So that, I think, is interesting, and the repeals were part of a much more general change in social attitudes. Most Americans by that time were much more aware of gays and lesbians as colleagues, as characters on sitcoms, and just in general in the fabric of American society. And that, I think, did very much help to undermine the politics based on disgust. So, on September 17th, 1998, John Geddes Lawrence, a medical technologist, age 55, was having consensual sex with Tyron Garner in Lawrence's Houston apartment. Unbeknownst to him, a neighbor named Robert Royce Eubanks, who had earlier been accused of harassing the plaintiffs and who had had a romantic relationship with Garner, so this was a kind of jealousy motivation, he phoned in a complaint of, quote, a weapons disturbance, end quote, in Lawrence's home, saying that a man with a gun was going crazy. And he admitted later that he had been lying, and he served 15 days in jail for filing a false police report. When the police arrived, they entered the unlocked apartment, and so this time they had a valid occasion to be there, at least they thought they did, with weapons drawn, and they arrested the two men. They were held overnight in jail and charged with violating Texas' sodomy law. Pleading no contest, they were convicted by a justice of the peace, but then they exercised their right to a new trial, and they asked the court to dismiss the charges against them. They cited both equal protection grounds, because Texas's law was not orientation neutral, it was just for same-sex partners, and due process liberty grounds. In December 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. On June 26, 2003, by a 6-3 vote, the court found in favor of Lawrence and Garner, overruling Bowers versus Hardwick, and in validating the extant state sodomy laws. Now, there was an interesting split in the majority about how we should think about this. For Justice O'Connor, who wrote a concurring opinion, the salient issue was equality. She didn't express a view on the question whether an orientation-neutral sodomy law would be unconstitutional on due process grounds. She argued that this issue need not be reached. So in other words, she was trying to get somewhere without overruling Bowers versus Hardwick. So she cited some other cases as precedents and argued that the state may not single out a class of citizens for special disadvantage merely because the majority doesn't like them. Moral disapproval of a group cannot be a legitimate governmental interest under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, that opinion, and it's often said that the best weapon to use in all these cases is equal protection, not due process. But here, I think you see both the promise and the limits of an equal protection-based approach. Certainly, it suffices to invalidate that particular law, and maybe it would suffice to invalidate other sodomy laws if you could really show clearly that enforcement was not neutral. But it doesn't address the more fundamental issue of intrusiveness and decisional liberty. It's typical of Justice O'Connor's cautious, incremental approach that she saw no need to decide that question when there was a narrower way of disposing of the problem. But the majority decided that the time had come to articulate boldly the nature of the liberty interest in intimate association and decisions about one's personal sexual life that the Due Process Clause, they argue, had long protected. Bowers, they argue, quote, was not correct when it was decided, and it is not correct today, unquote. The Bowers majority, they say, framed the liberty interest wrongly and too narrowly. Correctly seen, the present case, like Bowers, raises the very general question of the government's role in controlling intimate personal relationships. Quote, liberty protects the person from unwarranted governmental intrusions into a dwelling or other private places. Liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain intimate conduct, end quote. Justice Kennedy's majority opinion argues that private consensual sexual conduct is within the liberty zone of all persons to choose without being branded as criminals. Now, this is, I think, a correct and powerful interpretation of the liberty interests protected by the Due Process Clause. And he's also on very strong ground when he insists that due process liberty interests have in and of themselves an equality aspect, and that the equality interest can't be well served by a narrow approach through the idea of equal protection alone. But still, there is a problem, and the problem comes once more from the notion of privacy. Now, Lawrence does recognize that privacy has two aspects, the decisional and the spatial. After initial references to, quote, a dwelling or other private places, end quote, and, quote, the home, end quote, Justice Kennedy does say that the case, quote, involves liberty of the person both in its spatial and more transcendent dimensions, whatever that means. So it's a masterpiece of sort of vague, rather highfalutin language. And he grants, quote, there are other spheres of our lives and existence outside the home where the state should not be a dominant presence, end quote. But even with that said, the opinion goes on to rely rather heavily, albeit unclearly, on the spatial notion of privacy at key moments, suggesting a constitutional approach that I think is both overprotective and underprotective. The state, of course, does have a role in the home when harm is in the offing. And so it's not a government-free zone, as the opinion suggests, nor is it clear why the fact that the sex act performed by Lawrence and Garner was in the home is relevant at all. And surely the relevant issue is one of the interests of other parties, and Mill got it right. It's whether the act is self-regarding or other-regarding. No non-consenting party's rights are being violated, and because the conduct took place in seclusion, no non-consenting party is even being subjected to direct offense. And I think that that's all that needed to be said. The home is a red herring. Baird, in Eisenstadt versus Baird, gave contraceptives to undergraduates at a public meeting. And of course, countless protected acts of contraception do take place in public whenever a woman takes her pill at lunch or whatever. So the relevant issues are consent and offense, not location. As for actual sex acts, where there's always some potential for direct offense, well, suppose Lawrence and Garner had had sex in a hotel room instead of Lawrence's home. What would the court say there? Well, in that case, because of the room's home-like character, most people probably would think it should be similarly protected, and maybe the opinion does cover that, hard to tell. The relevant issues, again, are consent and seclusion. But what about sex in a private club for members only? In other words, no one who doesn't consent to watching these things is there. Well, I think that should just be like having sex in a bedroom or a hotel room for the purposes of constitutional law. But Lawrence offers absolutely no guidance as to whether that kind of sex act would or wouldn't be protected. What about having sex out in the woods, in a secluded spot where you could reasonably expect that no one else would be there? Well, Massachusetts police force has adopted a police policy saying that if that's the sort of thing we're dealing with, we should not arrest those people if they had reasonable care to seclude themselves. But the court gives us absolutely no guidance about that kind of case. What would have been helpful would have been a careful analysis of seclusion and offense, showing what's protected and what isn't. But that kind of analysis has not yet been offered by the court. So, in short, the Lawrence court, I think, hampered by a long tradition of confusion that goes back to Griswold, and I think also seeking public consensus by focusing on the home, which is always a resonant thing for Americans, articulated a theory of protected private conduct that's very, very unclear. It makes resonant general statements about decisional liberty, but then adds this little tag about the home as a protected space whose relevance to the liberty interest remains entirely undefined. We don't even know whether the spatial component is meant to be a necessary part of the liberty interest. That's how unclear the opinion is. Lawrence's great achievement, then, was certainly not conceptual clarity or even good practical guidance. That will have to come later, and let's hope that other cases will raise that issue. The achievement of Lawrence, though, I think, lies instead in a cast of mind, in a judicial approach to liberty interests that says these are individual interests of all human beings, and the state is not to let the majority interfere with our protection of all individuals. So in essence, it consists in a rejection of the Devlin-esque politics of disgust, which was evident in Bowers, together with the Devlin-esque conception of society as dominated by tradition and solidarity in favor of a politics of individual liberty and the ability to imagine the purposes of a variety of human beings. So instead of figuring as a class of outlaws condemned by the wisdom of the ages, gays and lesbians took their place in the judicial mind as equal citizens and what Kennedy nicely calls adult persons with interests like those of other people, quote, in deciding how to conduct their private lives in matters relating to sex. And that, I think, is an achievement of the moral imagination, because law is inseparably bound up with the moral imagination. It is also an achievement in law. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Now we open up questions.
Yes.
So one of the arguments that Justice Scalia makes and Lawrence is about the slippery slope idea that if you allow your sodomy, you have to allow bestiality and incest and polygamy. And I don't know if he made this comparison, but gays and lesbians are also compared to drug users often. So do you think that these sorts of crimes are also self-regarding, or can we make a distinction between them?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, and I think myself that the problem, I mean, I've written about polygamy in an op-ed in the Philly Inquirer. I'm not going to talk about it in this book, but I think that the real problem with polygamy is equality. Namely, polygamy as currently practiced in all societies that we know is actually a form of a male prerogative, and women don't have the same options. If you remove the sex equality, then I think it becomes much more difficult to say why some sort of consensual contractual arrangement among a plurality of people should be a problem. And suppose we had a group. I tried to think. Suppose we had a group who really, on religious grounds, preferred a form of polygamy that was sex equal. What would we say then if we were under the regime, whereas you couldn't the Sherbert regime, where you couldn't inflict a substantial burden on a person's religious freedom without a compelling state interest? So what would the compelling state interest be? Well, sex equality would be. But beyond that, maybe administrative complexity, but we rarely held that administrative complexity, unless it rises to a very high level, like, for example, the Native American who didn't want his daughter to have a social security number. That's not a compelling interest unless it's very, very severe. So actually, I don't have the problem with polygamy so long as there's real consent and there is the same option for a woman as for a man. Bestiality, since Animal Rights Week begins tomorrow, I shall say, to me, this is an issue of animal rights. I mean, there is no pain is inflicted on the animal. And furthermore, if you have a robust notion of consent, and I think rape law is best framed in such a way that only an affirmative statement of consent will count as real consent, not just the absence of no. So having that notion of consent for humans, I would also say that for animals, there's no possibility of satisfying that requirement by an affirmative statement of consent. So I just think that's the problem with bestiality, and I don't see any other problem with it. One of the things that's actually quite revealing is how difficult it is for people to justify laws against necrophilia, because there you don't have any problem on the other side. how to frame it? Is it a property crime? What is it? And a lot of states don't have such laws, and where they do, the penalties are really quite small. So the thing about incest is the other one that Scalia mentioned. Incest is usually involves child abuse. So of course, or if not parents abusing their children, some other kind of abuse of trust, uncle and niece or whatever. And suppose it doesn't. Suppose it's an adult brother and sister. Well, I don't really have any problem with that. I mean, there used to be all this eugenic stuff about the children. But then, if we're going to get into eugenics, then we should forbid people who have the taste of X gene from marrying and so on. And we don't do that. So I think, actually, you go back in Western culture's history, and there's tremendous romanticization of brother-sister incest. De Valkyrie, Byron, so what is going on here when people say that this is the horrible, horrible thing that this might lead to? I don't think that incest is terrible apart from an abuse of power. Drug addiction is not all the thing. Now, of course, we really need good facts about how damaging drugs are. Are they really more damaging than football? And so, because, there are plenty of things that seem to us iconic of health which do great damage to the body. Being a pitcher in a little league team is almost certain to do it. What percentage of kid pitchers actually don't injure their arms and shoulders? But so there are these. We ought to make those comparisons in good faith, and we shouldn't just let the scare word drug, bewitch us. But the thought that we compare gays and lesbians to people who are, the proverbial drug addict that Devlin recognized, who was so sunk in drug addiction that he couldn't fight in the army, that's absolutely ridiculous. We know now that gays and lesbians serve in the military. They serve very well. They're perfectly fine soldiers. So on just on the facts, that one seems to be wrong. Yeah?
I wonder if it's interesting that this notion of limiting most of these rights to the privacy framework whether that reduces disgust at all. I don't think it does, in the sense that you could say something should be allowed but hidden, in the same way that you would say an accident scene or an execution should be hidden even though it's allowed. It has nothing to do with the right of the person being executed. We just don't want to see it. And it has nothing to do with the right of the person who's had an accident. We just don't want to see that either. So the fact that we limit, that we define these rights in terms of privacy, it seems like it preserves all the disgust. It's just that we don't want to see it or talk about it, but the disgust might grow or might be completely independent of the problems.
Well, okay, now I have to get into what I really think about offense. I mean, I grant that what I call direct defense, that is having something take place when you are there, physically present, is something we really need to think about for purposes of law. But we need to think about it, I think, the closer it is to the traditional category of nuisance, the more legally regulable it is. That is, where there is something disgusting that's coming from the surrounding in ways that directly impinge on your senses, making it impossible for you to carry out your normal activities. So if your neighbor, let's say, has an open sewer on his property, that can be a cause of legal action. Now, what would be analogous to that in the sphere of personal conduct? Public defecation, it seems to me, is in that class. Okay, so that, even there, I would say we want to take account of constrained circumstances. The public defecation of a lawyer in the middle of a station on the way home or something, very different from a homeless person who has no other place to defecate. And of course, we typically, in another way too, we take account of constrained circumstances. I'm a distance runner. I know of no distance runner who's ever been arrested for public defecation, yet it's absolutely ubiquitous in every marathon. So constrained circumstances is recognized. So what about public masturbation? Now, of course, we can raise the issue of impact on children. And I think that's a very important thing. Frightening children could be something we worry about. Okay. Do we think that just the fact that sexual fluids are being released, that's physically disgusting in a way that is relevant to this category of nuisance? I'm not sure. I mean, it seems to me most people think it should be okay to regulate public masturbation, but I'm not secure about the grounds for that. Certainly the exhibitionist is a different kind of character because his goal is to alarm. And exhibitionism is a kind of assault. I mean, it's a stalking kind of crime. So that, put that to one side, but just think of somebody who's not an exhibitionist trying to threaten or alarm, who's just masturbating in public. It's very hard to justify the legal regulation of that. But I'm prepared, you know, to concede that to the opposition. And what I've said in this paper is I think that seclusion, therefore, is a relevant category. Why is that not the same as the court's notion of privacy? Because you can be secluded in many places that are not a home. You can be secluded in a hotel. You can be secluded in, very importantly, a sex club, where they make sure that no one who doesn't want to watch that comes in. By coming in, you consent to watching that. So I'm happy with the idea of seclusion being relevant, or at least rather happy, but not at all happy with its being equated with the home. Okay, so that's the critique. It's not like there's no relevant notion here. Yeah.
You earlier talked about the feminist suspicion of this right to privacy claim on the grounds that doesn't especially take into account power inequalities, like the so-called private sphere, the women or people are secluded or hotel room or sex room or what name is that outside of home. So if you said you want to push from the side and concentrate on the other angle of attack, if we're approaching it from that angle, then how do we end up like saying that power is corrupt? Like where do we locate the protection for, you know, stopping those attacks? If we are suspicious of privacy in the potential to create?
Well, it's the decisional. I mean, I think the relevant thing is rights of decision in certain intimate choices. And that has always been really at the heart of these cases, and really was at the heart of Griswold. I mean, Eisenstadt, in its reading of Griswold, makes clear that even though Griswold had this rhetoric about the marital couple and the home and so on, what was really going on was the protection of an individual decisional liberty. And therefore, it's protected for the unmarried as well as the married. So that's, I think, that's always been at the heart of these cases, and the home has always been a red herring. And why did they come up with this red herring? Who can say? I think that Griswold is just very badly argued and badly written. Who knows what Justice Douglas was thinking there. But Lawrence, I think, is a different story. I mean, I think it is characteristic of some of Justice Kennedy's opinions that he uses rather vague language. So it does have that feature that in common with a lot of his other opinions. But I think maybe there was an attempt to seek consensus by focus on the home.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.